Listening in live time, it's a Thursday at 11 o'clock time for Green Zine with Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson. Henry will sound like normal Henry. I'll sound like somebody who got tossed into a well, but that's okay. Got a pretty interesting show lined up for you. Listening to a little music from a group called the Faux Paws. Yeah, for you French speakers. Green Zine is brought to you today and every Thursday for several years now by Soliflect Bale. They have a new newsletter that just came out. We'll probably check that out during the course of the show. Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company. There you go, beer and coffee. Ooh. Solarfest. Going to be visiting Solarfest actually this weekend, having a gathering of the tribe over there, getting ready for next year's festival. Maybe Henry will want to go to that. White River Land Collaborative and a breakfast and lunch restaurant in Randolph called Wit and Grit. Let's listen to a little bit more music, and I'll bring Henry up in the mix, and we'll launch into the show. Second decade of broadcasting here at Royalton Community Radio, but this piece from the Faux Paws is called Fourth Decade, and I'm bringing up the slider, Channel 11. Henry, are you there?
I guess I should be. I'm not.
Yeah, you're definitely there. I'm hearing you loud and clear. We're going to let Henry do most of the talking today since my voice is pretty well out of commission. How you doing?
Those train rides may be energy efficient, but they also seem to be germ efficient.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so, always good to be back in the studio with you.
Yeah, good to have you back and in three quarters of a piece.
Yeah, something like that.
So today we're going to be doing a fairly deep dive, trying to understand how to make the grid better and to electrify everything. And we're going to be talking with a future designer from Velco, which is the Vermont electric utility that moves power around within the state. And we will, when we get to Dan, we will let him talk about that. I might say that last week I was in a bit of shell shock over the election comeuppances, and I complained or didn't complain, but I said that I thought that economic issues were what put us into this. And on listening to a lot of people talk about it, I've decided that it's almost a case of the Republicans and the Trump campaign doing just too good a job of convincing us that we are in terrible shape when we're not, even though people's pocketbooks are very tight with the inflation and without a commensurate rise in hourly wages.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of editorials written about the election and the strategizing and et cetera. But I guess what I've been reading mostly is what's the next step forward for those who want to retain what is here, which we think is helpful to our society, whether it's locally or statewide or around the country. And in my mind, the affordability issue was very important, even here in the state of Vermont. There were some major changes. The Republicans picked up quite a few seats in the legislature. It looks like David Zuckerman is going to be unseated as lieutenant governor, although neither candidate got 50% of the vote. But I guess this is an environmental show, and for policies that are in effect that may go away or policies that may be introduced, and we know there will be really zero help from the federal government when it comes to the environment for the next 4 years. So it's going to be up to states and local communities. And if the affordability argument is overblown so that we can't afford to have more electrification of our thermal units and of our transportation, well, where's the affordability part when you look down the road with more catastrophic storms and climate change in the trillions and trillions of dollars? I would say that's not very affordable.
I do think that the current administration is trying to lock up and get money shoveled out the door for various things to try to make it more difficult for the Trump administration to roll things back. And some of the things that they want to roll back actually are very, very beneficial to red states. And they're going to get some pushback from some of the their own Republican members of Congress. And
Even though the investment, I guess it was the Inflation Reduction Act, which is still spinning off money for the next several years. Now, I don't know if the new administration can stop that over the next few years or not. I haven't gotten that deep into it. That most of that money has gone to red states and created a lot of jobs, a lot of them in the renewable energy industry, et cetera, transportation. And as you said, Henry, there may be some pushback, I think, particularly from Republicans. There are a few non-MAGA Republicans still in the Senate, and maybe not all of his goals will be achieved because they will not look very good at home as having, even though they didn't support IRA, I don't believe any Republicans voted for IRA. Kamala Harris passed the deciding vote when we had a deadlocked Senate. They may change their tune now because their constituents have been used to the last 2 to 3 years of benefiting from a lot of the programs that IRA has created.
And speaking of benefits, Washington Electric, if you're on Washington Electric, you probably got their newsletter, but in case you didn't see the front page, there is money available that would get you $45 off your power bill every month for the next 5 years simply by signing up as a low-income person for tapping into solar production that they already have as a company.
That's $45 how often?
Every month.
Every month. Wow.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know if that's if that would pay for your connection fee or only for the electric use part. I expect it's only for the electric use part.
I would think so. And that, you know, they often have a generous range as far as what income they define as low income.
Yes. So there's two different levels, and I don't have those details in front of me, but there are benefits to people all the way up to 185% of low income.
Okay. I got you.
I don't know whether the solar will take you all the way to 185%. You may have to actually be a low-income person. But low income is, I don't know what it is. It's you know, it's 27,000 or something.
Yeah, per person.
Per person, so, and more for a household of numerous
people. And where could we find out more information?
Well, Washington Electric is so.
This is strictly for Washington
This is Washington Electric. Now, having said that, Capstone, we on 8/8, our show that we did with Capstone, those monies have not gone away and probably won't go away, that are for weatherization and for cost sharing on utilities, things, electric items like solar hot, or not solar, but heat pump hot water heaters and all that kind of thing is still on the table. And I believe the funding has already been distributed to the state, and it's being band-aided together right now, but it's actually going to be fully implemented this coming year.
Okay. Wow.
So and that doesn't, but they're able to band-aid it together right now, and going to your local community action group, which I think for South Royalton, I think that's Capstone out of Barrie.
Yeah, I know that if you're really serious about getting more details and want to sign up and have a visit, that guest that we had said it would be best to actually go to the Barrie office.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So some good news there, because I'm not sure we're going to be bringing a whole lot of good news to our audience today, Henry.
No, I think we should get into Bird Note.
All right.
Our guest is going to call shortly.
Yeah, our guest is coming. We do have Bird Note. I'm going to bring Henry down in the mix and bring up Bird Note. And this one today is called the Island Scrub Jay.
This is Bird Note. Only the most intrepid birders lay eyes on the striking cobalt feathers of the island scrub jay, one of the rarest songbirds in the U.S. You'll have to take a boat about 20 miles to California's Channel Islands National Park, then trek into the chaparral woodlands of Santa Cruz Island. There, an estimated 1,700 island scrub jays live in monogamous pairs, nesting within island scrub oak trees. The jays have few natural predators or competitors for food, letting them grow larger than their continental counterparts. But the birds' isolation makes them susceptible to diseases such as West Nile virus, which has an 85% mortality rate among related California scrub jays. Though the mosquitoes that transmit the virus don't like the island's chilly temperatures, climate change could help them spread. To prepare, scientists have launched an avian vaccination campaign. Another option being considered? Relocate some jays to nearby Santa Rosa Island, where they could help reestablish native oak trees when they bury the acorns in the ground. A double biodiversity win. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Yeah, I like that. Got to go to Santa Rosa Island and get those oaks going.
It's a very pretty jay, too.
Very attractive.
So you'll have a link up if you want to get a picture of it when we get our notes done for the show.
Yeah, interesting that they're under threat, not necessarily by other species, but by about this virus. And the insects, it's warming up at those Channel Islands.
And on that same subject, I attended the forestry section of the Climate Caucus yesterday. And one of the things that they have on the drawing board is to try to get control of invasive species as warmer weather is bringing new species into the state, and also to do some mitigation for things like bugs coming in and but the reason I attended was that I wanted to be sure that the proforestation and the idea of forests was still getting ample consideration. And I suggested that they should, in fact, stop any clear cutting, that you get warming when you have bare ground, and clear cut gives you bare ground. So quite separate of any other forestry reason or carbon reason, you actually are increasing warming when you allow big areas of sunlight to get to the ground in a forest situation.
Which really makes a whole lot of sense. Hey, we're just about to be joined by our guest here on Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio. But before we leave today, Henry, maybe in the last 5-10 minutes, we should also talk about the COP conference, which is just getting underway over in Azerbaijan. A little background on that. And then some local advice from Dan Caduto, that's a little op-ed piece that's in today's Herald. But why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest, Henry?
So, hi, Dan. Dan Copeland is the manager of innovation for Vermont Electric Velco. Let's see. Fill us in. What does that acronym stand for, Dan?
Morning, guys. This is Dan Copeland from Velco, Vermont Electric Power Company. Thank you so much for having me here.
Power Company. That was the part that I was. So thank you for joining Green Zine. And maybe we should just start off with a quick blast of who you are. What does it mean when you are the manager of innovation?
Thanks, Henry. So my role is to work with the operators, the planners, the engineers, and the technology teams, which are responsible for providing reliable transmission service across the state. What I do is actually work with them to identify ways that we can collaborate across teams more effectively, as well as look at all the new technologies that are coming down the road and make sure that we're prepared to provide reliable service, safe, efficient service with all the new technologies ahead.
So explain Velco's role in getting power from a power source to the customer.
Sure, absolutely. So in back in the 50s, Velco was created as the first transmission-only electric utility. And the point of doing that was actually the 17 distribution utilities, which were in operating at the time, brought together their collective resources and sought to bring that high-voltage transmission service to carry power from the New York area, specifically from the hydro in the St. Lawrence, into Vermont. And so it was through this economy of scale that the utilities brought together their resources. And today, Velco is doing just that, serving as a for-profit structure company, but delivering cooperative-like value. So when we make profit through our profit efforts, we are actually able to lower customers' rate pressures because that profit goes back to the distribution utilities and helps decrease rates. So what we're doing is we're actually maintaining connections to New York, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Quebec, and carrying power across those high-voltage transmission lines that folks will see driving down the highway or at the larger substations that we operate and maintain and secure.
So you are really the distribution network for electricity in the state of Vermont. Am I correct in that?
We'd say transmission network. We actually provide transmission service to our distribution utility owners, so Green Mountain Power, Vermont Electric Cooperative, Burlington Electric, as well as Washington Electric Co-op, Stowe, Hyde Park, and the Vermont Public Power Supply Authority utilities. So all of those are ultimately the distribution utilities that are responsible for the distribution. You can think about that like Valco's interstate highway. So like we're the 89 of Vermont. And Route 7 is like the sub-transmission. And roads off of Route 7, that's distribution. So it's helpful to think about Valco as just the transmission system, and we hand off at the sub-transmission level down to distribution.
And you're fairly unique. There isn't any other one that any other state that has done this. Am I correct about that?
Right. So we have through our for-profit structure and delivering value to our owners, we have a regulatory framework here in Vermont that really I think does Vermonters well, and that's exactly right. There are other transmission-only utilities. There are some also generation and transmission cooperative utilities across the country. But Valco, in terms of the way that we're structured and our focus on bringing costs down and making the transmission system affordable in Vermont, that is unique.
Okay. Well, let's dig into kind of what the how Vermont's power utilities first came into existence, how they worked then, and how things are changing now, because it's really a very different world now than it was in the early days.
Absolutely. So, you know, back in the early 20th century, many of the utilities had local generation, you know, supplied by, say, hydro units or, in some cases, coal. That was producing power for local usage. And as electricity demand across the state increased, and especially in the agricultural communities of Vermont, there was an interest in extending electric service to those areas. Many of the utilities that had been active really pooled their resources together and were seeking to bring service to all Vermonters. And really, Valco was part of that effort in terms of providing that transmission backbone. And over the past, you know, really 70 or so years, the effort to ensure that reliable transmission service is delivered, that stayed constant, right? So we've always been focused on that. But the resource mix, whether it's been going from hydro and coal to more natural gas, nuclear, and over time, right, more other efficient power plants. Like we have more and more units coming online, like combined cycle units that had happened. And with the increased emphasis on ensuring lower carbon generation comes on, that's where we see this proliferation of solar and wind and storage. And we're really seeing an unprecedented deployment of those assets and that generation mix to address the climate crisis across the nation. So New England and Vermont were no exception, but I think it's fair to say that what we're seeing here in the state is really the proliferation of distributed energy resources. So that's like solar photovoltaics and storage on people's homes, customers' homes. That really are changing the way that the grid operates. So we at the transmission level, we're staying focused on transmission service, making sure it's reliable, making sure it's safe and affordable. But what we need to be able to do is to anticipate how those new resources are changing the flows on the transmission network so we can continue to provide that reliable service customers are counting on.
So we're taking a a system that was designed from the power source out and managed by the utilities to a system where the power source is starting to be everywhere, on people's roofs, on local projects like community solar. I guess you've had the hydropower from the Connecticut River probably being fed into the system for quite a while.
Yep.
But it's made the whole thing much more complicated, and as an overall grid, with your mandate to have no interruptions, basically have dependable power so that you don't have to be keep looking over your shoulder as to whether you're going to be able to turn the lights on or not. That's in order for everyone to make good use of electricity, we need that dependability. Otherwise, people aren't going to want to do things like heat pumps if they don't think they're going to be able to, if they think they're going to have prolonged power outages.
Exactly. And we see across the state an increased emphasis on the importance of resilience. Yeah. And that's a really important development, especially as more and more innovations are being developed to enhance resilience for customers. So our distribution utility owners are really taking strides to advance that. And our regulatory model here in the state encourages innovative pilots. So our regulators have really created a framework where that can happen, and we can keep focused on delivering this affordable service to Vermonters. That's always has to be safe, reliable, affordable service. Has to be the emphasis of our work. And I should also just add that, you know, as electrification occurs and more use cases, just like the heat pump example you gave, as more and more electricity is used to move from, say, transportation usage or thermal heating usage, what we fully expect is that more transmission lines will need to be built in order to accommodate that. And so we're looking collaboratively with our partners in the north, Hydro-Quebec, to evaluate how we could bring in new bidirectional flows, transmission service that could ensure that, you know, let's say offshore wind is being produced in the Atlantic, connected in through our neighboring states, and we have the ability to actually move power from the offshore wind up to Quebec. Well, perhaps in that case, we'd be able to work with them to actually move power back from the hydro in Quebec back into Vermont. So there's a new collaborative way of working where we all collectively get together and say, we have to keep this electric grid reliable, safe, and affordable. What are the best ways to do that? So we're looking at all options.
Yes, and one of the driving costs for the grid infrastructure, I believe, is being able to not overload the system at any one particular point. And that much of the time the grid is only transmitting, I don't know what, 15-25% of its rated capacity, as it were. But yet we have to build for those peak demands, so that we don't get blackouts and get unreliable grid or melt the grid down. I mean,
right. There were lessons learned out of the 2003 blackout that really brought the attention to the importance of contingency analysis, which is the study of what happens to the grid when one part of it has an outage unexpectedly, and making sure that that network of lines and substations and continue to serve the demand for electricity that exists in the area. So after the 2003 blackout, there was a recognition that more contingency analysis was necessary in order to provide this reliable service that customers are counting on. So that's exactly right. We perform contingency analysis looking years ahead through our planning models, as well as contingency analysis every day. Actually, every 5 minutes, we run contingency analysis in our 24/7 control center. And what that does is make sure that we're prepared for all the what-if scenarios that could happen to ensure that we're ready for the changing grid.
So what I just want to jump in here for a second. What role does backup power? We know about Tesla power walls and people able to provide power from their EV depending on the type. But as far as the resiliency of the grid at a local level when the power goes down, is that also part of the contingency plan? Like, boy, if we have these large battery units, I know there's one outside of our town here in Royalton. Is that part of the planning that Velco is involved with?
Great question. So we're working actually collaboratively right now with our customer owners and stakeholders within the Vermont System Planning Committee, looking out at the years ahead of what's expected for electrification. And we're finding that with more flexible resources that would be operated by our distribution utility owners. That's exactly right. That flexibility could be a real source of value to the grid. So that is a planning study that we're doing right now, looking at how can we leverage the most and get the most out of these existing flexible assets to support the needs of the future system, because we know there'll be more electrification, but we don't quite know exactly how much flexibility there will be out there. So the more flexibility is there, the more that could help in contingency analysis. Exactly right.
And I noticed that when I'm in Vermont and I look at those high voltage transmission lines, that they have a little black cable that trails along following down those pole structures, which I believe is fiber optic. So every single one of your substations are hooked together by fiber optic. And when I was over in New Hampshire, I was looking at their high voltage transmission lines, and they don't have any fiber optics on their poles. Are we unusual in that we have the ability to communicate that way between substations and increase the amount of data that's available for planning?
Yeah, first of all, that's a great observation. And you're exactly right. Our technology team and telecommunications team have done excellent work over the past few decades, making investments that are really now seen as a national best practice. We actually own and operate 1,600 miles of fiber optic networks across the state that not only support monitor the electric system, but also aid in Vermonters' high-speed data internet access. So these are one of these assets. This is the fiber optic network asset that really pays enormous dividends is an incredibly important tool for us to maintain situational awareness of the grid. And that's exactly right. By virtue of what we can see, then we can make better plans. We can operate more safely, more reliably. The fiber optics are absolutely a key way of doing that.
So I know that Washington Electric put in smart meters, so-called smart meters, electric meters, so they wouldn't have to visit every meter and collect the data off it. And then they found that there were a lot of places they had to run trucks anyway. And so they are moving to smart meters that would connect through the internet so that there is more information and more room to do innovative things with customers that would make the grid more resilient and lower the cost of electricity for everybody. I believe that Green Mountain Power is also in that process or has executed. I don't know the level of their information technology that they can put through their system. But I know this isn't your territory. It's the utilities territory, but it seems to me that that there is a need for data all the way from the customer and perhaps even the customer's ranking of choice about, I know on my personal utility service, I have a transformer on my pole, which is only good for 40 kilowatts. That's a 40 amp breaker on 220. And yet I have 100 amp service installed, but that doesn't get me continuous 100 amps. And so if I want to put in solar and feed power back to the grid, or if I want to have an electric vehicle and I want to charge it fast, I have to consider not overloading that transformer. And I'm sure that same thing happens for the grid in general. With paying attention to making continuous use of moving electricity rather than big surges of demand. And I'm just trying to understand how that communications technology could keep the grid inexpensive and still make it very robust and do the job for us. You care to comment about the grand overview?
Well, I would say at the just at the outset, we think our distribution utility owners are among the most innovative utilities in the country. And actually, the Department of Energy recently has weighed in. They have a blog post about some of the projects that we're doing, some of the research and development projects they're doing in Vermont. And they're seeing that what's happening in Vermont is really indicative of where the rest of the country needs to go. So just at the outset, I would just want to acknowledge that our distribution utilities are leading the way. Where we come in from a transmission standpoint is thinking about how we can ensure that the contingency analysis, the transmission availability is there regardless of what the distribution utilities pursue. So from the standpoint of, you know, some distribution utilities may offer certain programs, others may offer different programs. We just need to be prepared from the standpoint of the transmission system to be able to support a utility that says, hey, you know, we're going to support the proliferation of electric vehicles, or another who says that we're going to support the proliferation of battery energy storage. We need to have that wide area transmission view to really make sure that as those distribution utilities pursue programs with their customers, that we can support our customers, which are the distribution utilities, right? So we're the transmission supporting distribution, and then those distribution utility customers work with them to figure out what services to provide. So on our end, we are thinking about how we can provide better service to the distribution utilities so that as they pursue these innovative programs, we can help accelerate and enable these new functionalities. I would also just support what you said in terms of the criticality of communications infrastructure and fiber optic networks on our end, right? It's just at the transmission level and thinking about visibility for, and monitoring for transmission level contingency analysis. But there's no question that more and more communication infrastructure is really helpful to enabling flexibility. We see that across the entire country, and that's certainly the case here in Vermont.
Yeah, so let me jump to a question. Our next week's guest is going to be someone who is going to talk about do-it-yourself solar, and with especially used panels being available at pretty low costs, there's the option to just put up way more solar panels than you want, maybe hook it up with your electric vehicle, and cut your connection with the grid and not be paying for that. I realize this is a utility problem rather than a Velco problem, but I'm wondering whether you see any worry, just like copper phone lines have all but disappeared and everything is wireless. Do you see a threat from people cutting their connection to the grid?
Well, I'd say that this is definitely an area out of my territory here, so I want to acknowledge that. I appreciate the question and would just say, you know, it's so important for customers to have safety first when they're thinking about all the options, and working with the utility can absolutely support safety. And I think no matter, you know, what solution the customer's thinking about, right, it's really important to always keep safety in mind. I would also just say that, you know, from the standpoint of all the different utility programs that are out there, you know, reaching out and contacting the utility to learn more about the programs that are out there can really be helpful in helping make informed decisions. So I would just encourage listeners to contact our distribution utility owners, whether, you know, in any part of the state, to really just get the information and put safety first.
Yeah, so I want to leapfrog back onto the grid. I actually, as Henry knows, live off the grid, but we are grid tied down in our barn. So my query is about, as you're planning ahead with all the other distribution utilities here in the state of Vermont, and you're looking at more and more energy needs being moved to electricity, oil and gas hopefully will be used less and less to power buildings and heat buildings, etc. As far as efficiency of how that electricity is used by the consumer, is that also part of an objective that Velco has?
Yeah, so what we end up doing actually in our transmission planning process that we're going through at the Vermont System Planning Committee is actually developing what's called a load forecast. And load is just a term of art to refer to electric demand, right? So we make an electric demand forecast. And as part of that forecast, we actually include really robust data that comes from the energy efficiency utility for the state, Energy Efficiency Vermont. And that energy efficiency forecast ultimately is reflected in the load forecast. And so we've been doing that for a very long time and actually have, in past years, actually been able to identify what are called non-transmission alternatives through the proliferation of energy efficiency and distributed generation that have actually been able to support reducing costs of the transmission system for Vermonters. So Velco really led the way in the nation on that front. So I would say absolutely, and from the standpoint of the Vermont System Planning Committee, we're always looking at non-transmission alternatives to building new capacity first and foremost, as is required, but also it's just the right thing to do. So we're always thinking about how we can bring those make sure that those assumptions in terms of what those new technologies are going to do are reflected in our plans. And that's really the emphasis that we have in terms of our objective there.
So I realize again that your focus is on moving power around and getting it distributed within the state. But I'm wondering if you have a vision for what the grid of the future would look like with which is sort of happening to us now, but hasn't yet gotten very integrated or smart. What do you think a future grid will look like when there is a lot of decentralized power? How's that all going to fit together?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I'd say that from what we're seeing right now, that future grid is going to really require collaboration between people working together. And, you know, in many ways, just like we talked about at the outset of the call, the new generation mix is more decentralized, right, more distributed across the system. And that actually means that roles and responsibilities between the transmission and distribution companies are going to need to get more clear, making sure that we at the transmission level have our clear focus on the delivery for the transmission system and that distribution utilities have clear roles and responsibilities there so we can collaborate in new ways and make sure that the service that we do provide to customers is exactly, you know, what's needed to meet this surge in demand, whether it's from electric vehicles or from heat pumps or any new technologies. So the future grid really is going to require a lot of collaboration and working together in new ways. And I think what often these conversations talk about is like the new technologies or the new paradigms of how the system might operate in terms of, say, you know, communications infrastructure. But what we're really thinking about is how do we make sure that the people who are working on these new networks are trained, right, that they have the all the information at their fingertips to do that type of collaboration, to work together in new ways. And so many of the projects that we're pursuing are all about enhancing that collaboration, making sure that we're all speaking the same language, making sure that we're all aware of all the different assumptions that are out there, because it's actually going to be incumbent upon us to share new ideas, to share ways of working that allow us to partner more effectively with our customer owners and allow us to deliver that service. So I think about that grid of the future as really being one in which people are working together more efficiently, more effectively than they've ever worked together before. And that really just comes back to the fundamentals of making sure that we're using language that's clear, that making sure that everyone's on the same page about the deployments and what the potential impacts are going to be and those roles and responsibilities that I mentioned before. So really those interpersonal workflows and those interpersonal collaboration points, those are more important than ever in the grid of the future.
So I listened to the latest Volts podcast with Mary Powell from Sunrun, and they commented, and I think the New England grid is in much, much better communication with its with its utilities and customers than other places in the country. But they made the comment that it's very slow to rethink and retool the power delivery system at the utility level, because it's been a very sleepy, there were nothing changed year to year, and so it's not full of people like you who are in charge about thinking about innovation. And they're saying that, you know, doing it outside of the utility structure, you know, is the way to get fast change, and that we are seeing certainly a ramp up of demand from AI is putting a lot of pressure on generation right now, and that with the Trump being elected, Bitcoin mining is going to go full tilt. So that'll be yet another demand on the grid. And then we have practical things like EVs that the car companies are already pretty committed to having to build. And they're going to come to a point where they are cheap enough so that they're going to be very much in demand, and there will be a much more rapid adaptation to them than we've been seeing. I guess we saw a doubling from last year into this year, but it seems to me there's the possibility of that being a tripling or quadrupling in some of the next few years. Do you think that the planning for grid load, for that demand on the system, is ramped up high enough, or is paying attention to these kind of immediate changes in our usages that seem to be coming at us?
Yeah, great question. So I think in the whatever future year we look at, right, whether it was even looking back, you know, when we started a lot of this planning, when we looked at the year 2015, or if we look at the year 2020, or 2035, or even 2045, the constant is that customers are going to count on safe, reliable, and affordable service, whether at the transmission or at the distribution level. And that will be a constant, right? We know that certainly will be the case. And so when it comes to the obligation to serve and to ensure that electricity is safe, reliable, and affordable, we know that's going to be necessary to ensure that customers are getting the service that they're expecting, and making sure that the system that it as designed is actually delivering. And so if we are you know, stay focused on our mission, which is to serve as a trusted partner, help create a sustainable Vermont here at Velco, I think what we're going to end up doing is, as these new technologies proliferate, whether it's all the examples that you listed, whatever those might be, or even new technologies we haven't even dreamed up yet, if we stay focused on that function, then I think what will likely happen is that it will be clear that in order to satisfy those expectations of customers for that safe, reliable, and affordable service, we're going to have to work collaboratively to design that system in order to achieve those broad objectives. So a lot of the time when these new technologies proliferate, what we end up finding is that some of the assumptions that we've made, you know, in previous plans might need to get tuned, different functions might need to be changed here and there. But more than anything, if we stay focused on our core mission and our vision and values, that's I think what is going to be the key for delivering that service to Vermont. So again, safety, reliability, and affordability, regardless of the technologies that proliferate, that's going to be something that I think we're going to have to step up and make sure we can do.
Yeah. So I believe that Mary Powell did say that she thought that the customer was always going to want to not have to think about it. They just want to be able to turn the lights on and have them work. So she was 100% with you on that. And I think that's true. I think it's the weird outliers like Todd and me that might be willing to think about when it was the best time to charge their car rather than having it happen automatically. So good luck. And I gather that one of your jobs is to, in fact, keep this this level of conversation going between the different utilities. And I wish you great luck in because they don't really have the many of them don't have the infrastructure to spend a lot of time thinking about this. So you're having to push them to think about it so as to make everything work. And I appreciate that role of being the convener of thinking. So
thanks for having me, Henry. It's been a pleasure to talk to you both, and really enjoyed today's conversation. Grateful to be working in a state with such innovative utilities already. And so I just would express gratitude to all the utility partners that we have and really to folks we work with at the Vermont System Planning Committee who help really ensure that we're considering all the different options. So, of course, that's a public meeting. And if folks want to find out more about it, we can, of course, provide some information over. I think, Henry, you're familiar with the VSPC, but I really do think that that's a great way for folks to come and learn about what's going on and who are all the different players and what our obligations are to make sure we can provide that reliable, safe, and affordable service. So, again, thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
We'll put links up in our webpage.
Take care.
Right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
So a question I was not going to put to Dan that came to mind, particularly when you brought up the subject of additional energy usage coming from Bitcoin and from servers for AI. There are some communities in the country, I don't think at the statewide level yet, that are arguing with their legislature about prohibiting the building of large servers to accommodate Bitcoin and AI. I wonder if going to one of those open meetings, this is probably pretty early on. I haven't heard about a company wanting to come to Vermont and set up a big server, but is it automatic? Is it a requirement that the state or Velco or the individual utility needs to provide a whole new unit that's going to handle this increased load that some people may see is not necessary?
I think it's going to be price sensitive and also distance sensitive. Bitcoin can be mined anywhere, but AI facilities actually have to be close to people centers. The transmission time it takes to get back and forth over the over a fiber optic network actually messes with the effectiveness of AI. So it's going to be they're going to want to be near urban centers where there is increased demand for data massage, as it were.
Yeah,
and I don't think Vermont is exactly in the middle of a great.
Yeah, we're in a sense we're kind of off the grid at the moment as far as the interest in yeah. AI entities, and my understanding also with AI the servers is the amount of water that is required to keep things cool there. That would seem to be another natural resource demand that may not work in a lot of locations. So.
Well, it would be the ideal place to have a like a ground source, but instead AI a cooling center heating a neighborhood.
Okay,
so you could you could do some fun things you were in the right place.
That might make it a little more palatable.
And I don't think that it has to be an enormous structural space. So it could probably happen in Manhattan or someplace like that. That there you had a place to dump all that heat. You had all those office buildings to heat and so forth.
Yeah. Hey, let's shift gears really quick here, Henry. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show. I have brought up Elise Tillinghast's regular column in Northern Woodlands, and we are getting towards the end of the second week in November and things you can look for out in the woods. And we would highly recommend you check out Northern Woodlands, which is published over in Lyme, New Hampshire, pretty near to here. So this week in the woods, you could probably find some striped wintergreen, also known as spotted wintergreen, Prince's Pine, and Pipisewa. I like that. Sounds like a Native American word. A small plant in the blueberry family is relatively uncommon in the upper valley, but you may find it growing in patches of sandy, well-drained upland forest. Also, partridge berry. It looks like you can find that, an easier evergreen out there. The round-leaved herb grows close to the ground in the rich soils of deciduous forests, tolerating shade between spring and fall. They may prefer inclines and stream banks in part because the leaf litter is more likely to fall or wash away in these settings rather than bury partridge berry and block its light. A little bit further along in this walk in the woods update for week two in November, talks about sphagnum moss, lots of species of sphagnum moss in northern New England. More sphagnum in a beech stand closer to the Northern Woodlands office in Lyme hosted these springtails. They're also called snow fleas. Now, I didn't know that was the name for snow fleas. No snow yet down here in the valley, but it's coming along. So once again, that taken from the autumn edition of Northern Woodlands. Back to you, Henry.
Yes, the weather we get, the shifting weather, which always is fascinating to me, that spring and fall you can have such enormous swings between record highs and record lows. And it's all has to do with what's happening with the jet stream and whether that reason we got a clear, cool day yesterday was we had wind carrying a high-pressure zone that was moving air down from the northern area, but it can be polar air. It can be air that is carried all the way to Florida to kill citrus crops that's come from the North Pole. And so this is interesting time of year. We've certainly seen the warm stretches, and I'm sure we're going to see some cold ones before we're done here. Global warming is warming, but not taking away from the roller coasters.
Well, we're going to jump back up to the federal level. Of course, we have a new administration coming into Washington. A lot of cabinet officials are being nominated, not necessarily in office until the president takes office, but a lot of them need to be vetted and passed by the Senate. And most of them probably will be, including Lee Zeldin, who President-elect has nominated as the new head of the EPA. And Zeldin said, "We will restore U.S. energy dominance, revitalize our auto industry to bring back American jobs, and make the U.S. the global leader of AI. Wasn't he an EPA guy? And then finally he says, "We will do so while protecting access to clean air and water." That's a pretty big job he's taken on.
Yes, I don't know. The truth is in the baking of the pudding. So next week we will have Thomas Hand. He is a solar developer, but also understands all the little details of off-grid solar. Yep. And we'll just get a grand overview from him. And yes, when you're generating power for your house, it can be lethal. So we'll try to make sure the safety discussion is covered.
Yeah, you might want to have an electrician check everything out before throwing the switch. Hey, it's been great to join you here at Green Zine, Henry Swayze and myself. And Green Zine is brought to you today by Soloflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Henry, I'll look forward to next week with you, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wouldn't that be nice? I put my heart in the freezer. I put my love on hold. I tell myself...